Back now with Day to Day. 50 years ago today, the U.S. launched its first satellite, Explorer 1, into orbit. The Russians had already sent Sputnik 1 and 2 into space, so the successful American launch was a big victory for NASA. Back then, space was a pristine place, but no longer. Nowadays, space is cluttered with dead satellites, abandoned spacecrafts, even a few golf balls. But one orbit's trash is another man's treasure, and that man is Thomas Dorman. He tracks space junk from his home in Horizon City, Texas, and he joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Glad to be here, ma'am.
So explain exactly how this works. How do you find this celestial garbage, and how do you look at it?
Well, I personally use some computer programs that allow me to track these satellites. I get information from different sources, such as the U.S. Space Command, and also public sites. So this allows me to know where these objects are and when they will pass over my house and how high they will pass over my house, and sometimes the brightness of them.
And I assume you're looking at these things through a telescope.
Sometimes, yes. Sometimes a lot of it's naked eye. Like this morning, I was up at 3 o'clock, and I watched the pass of several spacecraft, one of those being the Hubble Space Telescope.
That's pretty cool. So what is this stuff? What does the junk stuff look like when it's passing overhead?
Most of the time, even in a small amateur telescopes or naked eye, it'll just be a dot of light moving across the sky. Sometimes this junk can flash when it's visible to the naked eye. Also, in telescopes, it can obviously flash.
And how does this stuff wind up there in the first place? I mean, do astronauts just throw stuff out the window? I mean, it seems a little odd.
Yeah, well, there's stuff been lost by the astronauts who have worked on the International Space Station. A lot of it is left behind by launching spacecraft into orbit. And also, there's been explosions on orbit that has left space junk out there. So, but there is a good effort by the international community to try to limit it now because they realize the problems it causes now and in the future for spacecraft and operations on orbit around the Earth.
And what kind of problems do they cause?
Well, they can cause impacts such as, I think it was last year, one of the space shuttles received an impact on one of the radiators, and it did cause a little bit of damage, and they are a danger to astronauts doing repairs such as the spacewalk that happened yesterday.
Mr. Dorman, what goes up must eventually, I would think, come down. Do you have any items of space junk that have landed here on Earth?
You have to realize that there's laws, international laws, that govern even space junk, and that there's some return to the country of origin. If it can be determined where it came from, you got to give it back.
Thomas Dorman, watcher of space junk, spoke with us from Horizon City, Texas. Thanks for talking with us.
No problem, ma'am. Hope I helped you.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris. With just 190 days to go until the Beijing Olympics, the Chinese capital is making good progress on its major projects. New hotels, stadiums, and subway lines are all on schedule. However, one issue remains, and it's a big one: pollution. Beijing admits it has an uphill fight to solve its air pollution problem before August. As NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports, the government is preparing to order cars and trucks off the streets to help.
There are some days here after a big wind or rain when you can stand on the street and look all the way across town and see the mountains to the north and west. And then there are days when the smog is so bad, you wipe your nose and your tissue turns black. Your eyes and throat burn. And government notices in the newspapers advise you not to go outside if you can possibly help it. Beijing Environmental Protection Bureau official Wang Xiaoming shows us where the government gets its information. What you're looking at here is an air quality monitoring station, he says. There are 27 of these around the city, and each one sends data in real time to our control center. Inside the control center, huge screens on the wall show levels of pollutants at different places throughout the city. Wang explains that today's air pollution index is 68, on a scale of 0 to 500, with 0 being the cleanest. Upstairs, the Bureau's deputy director, Du Shaozhong, admits that the city still has a long way to go to clear the air.
We're facing up to the fact that Beijing's air quality really needs improvement. But we can definitely say that in recent years, Beijing's air quality has constantly gotten better.
Du says that Beijing has spent nearly $14 billion over the past decade to fight air pollution. The city met its clean air targets on 245 days last year, compared to 177 days in 2000. Du adds that last summer, the city conducted a dress rehearsal for the Olympic Games. It ordered a third of the city's 3 million cars off the streets and significantly reduced pollution.
This was also a test of the public support for traffic controls during the Olympics. Beijing's residents are willing to make this effort for the sake of better air quality.
I think they'll do a lot of things when it comes to the crunch and the games are, you know, coming up.
David Streets is a senior scientist at the Argonne National Laboratory near Chicago. He's studied Beijing's air pollution and says beating it will require cooperation from other parts of North China.
Our modeling showed that at ground level, concentrations of pollutants from provinces that are fairly close to Beijing are very significant.
Already, construction sites and factories in Beijing are preparing to stop work ahead of the Olympics. Lai Ting is a worker helping to build a new expressway around the city. We'll take 3 or 4 months of vacation, he says, and go back to work when the Olympics are over. We just have to go with the flow. Everybody will have to take a vacation then, whether they want to or not. In a worst-case scenario, some Olympic events may have to be put off for a day or two until the pollution clears. Jill Geer is director of communications for USA Track and Field, a national governing body. She says that athletes are preparing, at least mentally, for some bad air.
We're very confident that the Chinese will take the measures necessary to make sure that the air is clear by the time the Olympic Games roll around. That said, we're working with our athletes to make sure that they know they need to train for possible heat and pollution.
The U.S. track team will be training ahead of the Games in northeast China's Dalian City, where the air is cleaner. But Geer says that's standard procedure and not related to the pollution. And she adds that the U.S. team has always thrived in adverse conditions, including 4 years ago in the intense heat of Athens. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Beijing.
In last night's State of the Union address, President Bush said the U.S. is committed to confronting global climate change. One of the places that change is becoming most visible is Antarctica. The Antarctic is part of the great weather machine that shapes climate around the world, and its layers of ice have recorded 400,000 years of climate history. Now that some of that ice is melting, tourists who once came for the wildlife and the natural beauty are also coming to see a planet in peril. NPR correspondent Gwen Tompkins is on just such a trip for our Climate Connections series with National Geographic. She joined us from the Norwegian ship, the MS Fram. And Gwen, where are you right now? Out in the water, I know that.
Yes, we are in the water, Renee. We have been sailing since Saturday evening. For the first 36 hours, we saw nothing. We saw not even a smidgen of dry land. And since then, we've seen some amazing glaciers covered in a powdery white snow. But if you look at the relief of some of the glaciers, you notice that the snow is actually a pale blue, just a gorgeous blue.
Talk to us about the people who are on the cruise with you.
The people who are here, they all appear to be very excited about the prospect of seeing this continent and stepping on it for the first time. Many of them are inveterate travelers who want to see all 7 continents on the Earth, and this is their number 7. So the people here tend to be drawn to this form of nature, drawn to some degree because they appear worried that it won't be here forever for humankind to enjoy.
So they're very aware of the notion that it's, as we were saying a moment ago, a part of the planet that's in peril.
Absolutely. In fact, I think to a person, they've all seen the Al Gore film, Convenient Truth, and I think that has definitely spurred their interest.
You just spoke of the ice being blue. It sounds quite dreamlike. Tell us more about that. Give us a sense of how this experience takes you from the familiar to what?
The ice is blue. And that was one of the most shocking realizations that we've made so far. You know, Antarctica is so different from the Arctic, it's a circle, because at the top of the world, there's only the ice cap. There is no land. But here, what we're looking at are mountains, dark brown or black mountains that are covered in glaciers.
It sounds pretty spectacular.
It is, Renee. Yesterday, we set our boots on the ground for the first time on a barrier island. It was so exciting, in large part because when you think about these sort of ice paradises, you think that they're going to be silent places, you know, where you can listen to your heartbeat or you can listen to your breathing. But no, you get onto these islands in the vicinity of the Antarctic continent, and they're loud places. You know, you hear the ice, you know, I mean, cracking. You actually hear or see ice falling from glaciers into the water.
When you say you can hear the ice cracking and seeing ice fall into the water or the ocean, does it make it easier to believe that climate change is happening, that it's a real event, that the Earth is fragile?
Well, the people on board here are very concerned that is exactly what they're seeing. But at this point, you know, it's very difficult to tell whether these glaciers are melting as a result of climate change or whether this is a natural course of how glaciers behave in this part of the world. Certainly, there's compelling evidence to suggest that global warming is affecting the periphery of the Antarctic continent. But for right now, people are still caught up in the majesty of what they're seeing.
Gwen, we'll leave you with that as you head for the Antarctic Peninsula there on the MS Fram, and thanks very much.
Thank you, Renee.
We'll be hearing reports from NPR's Gwen Tompkins this coming March when Climate Connections is all Antarctica.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. Time now for our series, Climate Connections, with National Geographic. Climate change means, among other things, an inevitable rise in sea level. And that's going to make it increasingly difficult for some low-lying countries to control flooding. Well, now, architects in Holland are turning adversity into opportunity. They are designing a new Holland, one that could actually float. The Dutch government seems willing to try the scheme, and other countries are interested as well. NPR's Joe Palca visited Holland, and he reports now on how they're responding to climate change with creativity.
With the exception of the major highways, it feels like you can't drive more than a mile or so in the Netherlands without running into water.
In 400 meters, turn left.
It could be the sea, it could be a river.
In 500 meters, turn right.
It could be a canal. But getting from here to there means making a lot of turns.
Prepare to turn right.
On this gray day last November, my producer Rebecca Davis and I are going to a town called Maasbommel on the Maas River.
We're going to see a lady who owns a floating house.
Actually, it's not really a floating house.
I guess that's a misnomer. It's a house that if the water level...
When possible, make an authorized U-turn.
I thought she wanted me to turn here.
Anyway, as I was saying, it's not really a floating house. It's a house that can float because it has a unique foundation. So we turn around and eventually find the driveway that takes us down to a cluster of these cool-looking houses along the river. They have a nautical feel with curved lines and colored wooden planking. We're looking for number 2-31, the house of Anna Vandermolen. But we can't find it. So we start knocking on doors. We want to see the inside of one of these houses. Finally, we find someone who's home.
My name is Marianne Smits.
S-M-I-T-T-S.
Yes.
Miss Smits is a delightful, energetic woman. If I had to pick one adjective, I'd pick perky.
Look, the water. We like the water. We have a boat.
She invites us in for a tour.
So the house is very big inside.
It has the look of a typical split-level house. A living room faces the river, stairs lead to a bedroom and back, and to a master bedroom above the living room.
We are two of us, me and my husband, so it's big enough for us.
I would like to see the foundation, is that okay?
Yes, it's no problem. Okay. Come. Watch the hat. I'm not so tall, so for me it's no problem. This is on the water.
This is underwater.
This is on the water.
Ah.
The temperature is always good here.
Ah.
And
good for storing your wine.
You have seen in my wine.
Well, I saw some wine.
Yeah,
as
we are making our own wine.
Nice.
Yes. Yeah.
So this is actually, so we're in an enclosed basement with a low ceiling.
Yeah.
And really, the moss is around us.
Yes.
I mean, you poke a hole in the wall, and you're going to have water come in.
No, there's no water coming.
But I mean, if I were drilling a hole.
Yeah, that's correct. Yes, yeah.
You see, Mariana Smits's foundation actually sits in the river. If the river level rises to flood stage, the house and the foundation float up with the water level. Flexible pipes keep the house connected to electrical and sewer lines. The house hasn't floated yet, but the prediction is that with global warming, the river will flood about once every 12 years. This ability to cope with floodwater rather than be devastated by it is why Smits moved here.
In the other village we have lived, there was always the water. I was very scared. Two times we have evacuated to leave our old house. It was very scary for us. And we got the opportunity to buy this house. It's a safe place.
In fact, global warming and the increased risk of flooding it brings is causing some architects in Holland to change their philosophy. Chris Zevenbergen is with Dura Vermeer, the company that built Mariana Smits's house.
So the whole idea is that in our designs, we should always take into account what will happen when there's an extreme event.
In the past, the Dutch only built homes in places where dikes made flooding unlikely.
The concept that, in fact, you build in an area where a flood may occur is completely new.
New and attracting attention. Go ahead and build houses in areas that might flood. Just build them on floating foundations.
Ja, dat storyboard ziet er niet anders uit dan een van het of de
At his office in The Hague, Kuhn Althaus drums his fingers on his desk while he's fielding calls from all over the world, from people interested in water architecture.
Yeah, exactly.
Althaus is bursting with energy. He's the co-founder of a firm called Water Studio. It's a small office with a dozen or so youngish employees. Althaus's projects go beyond the idea of simply keeping the house and its contents dry. He starts sketching on a pad.
The next step is that we not only make the house floating, but we make the complete garden floating.
Why not, he says. Why lose all those pretty Dutch tulips just because it floods? After all, Althaus says building floating foundations is a snap. Just fill a concrete box with some kind of plastic foam, flip it over, and you've got a stable platform that's ready to float. And the more of these platforms you join together, the more stable they are. Althaus doesn't plan to stop at single-family homes.
You see a floating foundation with a garden on top of it, a swimming pool on top of it, and the house on top of it. And you can fix those gardens, floating gardens, to each other and making a floating village of it.
All the projects Althaus has been describing are still on the drawing board. But the Dutch government has set aside some money and space to try building some of these floating architectural concepts. And Althaus is confident that people are ready for a new way of living.
The momentum is just right because of the climate change, because of the Al Gore story, because of New Orleans, because of the financials of this moment. Everybody is waiting for new innovations.
And those innovations are coming. Chris Zevenbergen's company has already built floating greenhouses and has designs for floating roads, even houses that not only float, but move.
You can move them along the river and go to a city which is close to the river and park your home there in a special harbor which is constructed for this type of purpose. So that we call a nomadic way of living, that you can change the area where you live depending on the season or whatever.
If this sounds a bit like turning the lowly houseboat of yesterday into tomorrow's design for living, well, basically it is. But the point is, suddenly, climate change is no longer a dire threat, but an opportunity for innovation.
There are infinite possibilities. That's the idea. Everything is, in fact, possible. Nothing is impossible. Sounds crazy, eh?
Or not. Joe Palca, NPR News.
You can see how rising seas could change coastlines around the world and get the latest Climate Connections features from National Geographic magazine at npr.org.
Marine biologists met in Washington this past week to launch the International Year of the Reef. Two new reports suggest that the world's underwater rainforests need help. NPR's John Nielsen has more.
Since the 1980s, coral reefs near Jamaica have been wounded by man-made problems like pollution and overfishing. But in the summer of 2005, a different threat arrived when freakishly warm waters triggered a so-called mass bleaching event that turned more than 90% of Jamaica's reefs into underwater ghost towns. Ainsley Henry, a reef expert with the government of Jamaica, remembers diving in and seeing no signs of life.
We were like in shock. You know, on an ordinary dive, you swim around, you go looking for stuff. On this dive, it was pretty much like standing up with your mouth open, looking at something and going, what?
Stories like that one were all too common at the first official meeting of the International Coral Reef Initiative. It's one of several Year of the Reef projects, and it's sponsored jointly by the Bush administration and the government of Mexico. One thing this initiative wants to do is draw attention to coral bleaching, which could become a lot more common under global warming. Mark Eakin is with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
The problem of coral bleaching is one that's been getting worse. It's continuing to get worse now, and we can only expect it to continue to get worse in the near future.
Scientists like Eakin help prepare two new reports that seem to highlight the troubles facing coral reefs. One predicts that severe coral bleaching in the Caribbean could be an annual event by the end of the century, and the other looks at threats to deep water coral reefs that aren't necessarily hurt by warming surface waters. But Eakin says climate change is expected to make the ocean more acidic, which will make it harder for all corals to grow, and he's sure that climate change is coming.
From the global perspective that NOAA's satellites provides, we've been able to see this change around the world, and it's a frightening change.
The Year of the Reef is designed to help devise new ways for countries to deal with these changes. Australian reef expert Clive Wilkinson says a good first step would be for Western countries to start helping poorer countries start enforcing so-called paper reef protection zones.
And a lot of countries have marine protected areas. You can find them on a map, but you won't find any evidence of them out in the field.
Experts like Wilkinson say the U.S. has been both a leader and a laggard in the effort to protect the world's coral reefs. Several years ago, the Bush administration set the standard for coral reef preserves when it created one of the world's largest marine reserves in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands. But at the same time, Wilkinson and others say the White House has resisted efforts to require reductions in global warming gases that help to put the reefs at risk. John Nielsen, NPR News, Washington.
And this is NPR News.
And it's time for Climate Connections, NPR's year-long series with National Geographic. Countries struggling with climate change could learn a lot from a constellation of tiny islands in the Indian Ocean. The Republic of Maldives was one of the first countries to recognize the danger of rising sea levels. It's also one of the first to come up with a plan to adapt to a warmer world, and a strategy to pay for that plan. NPR's John Hamilton has the story.
In the Maldives, you can climb a small palm tree and be higher than the highest point of land. These islands burst through the surface of the ocean thousands of years ago when a chain of underwater volcanoes erupted. They've been subsiding ever since. But the very tops, now capped with coral sand, remain above water.
In the remote Indian Ocean lies a paradise that is called Maldives Islands.
For most of their history, Maldivians lived off of fishing, but now there's tourism.
These are islands that are bathed in sunshine and washed with pristine blue waters.
Unfortunately, those waters are threatening to wash away the entire country. And that's what President Mamoun Abdul-Gayoom has spent the past couple of decades talking about, almost nonstop.
I stand before you as a representative of an endangered people.
That's Gayoom addressing the United Nations Earth Summit way back in 1992.
We are told that as a result of global warming and sea level rise, my country, the Maldives, may sometime during the next century disappear from the face of the earth.
It was a dramatic claim at a time when few people had even heard of climate change. Now, scientists agree that the Earth is getting warmer and polar ice is melting.
This water has to go somewhere.
Aziz Abdul Aziz Hakim runs a marine research lab on the island of Vaban Faru.
I'm sure this, some of this water would come into the Indian Ocean also. And there is no way that we can prevent this water coming into the Indian Ocean, into the Maldives.
Aziz says floods are nothing new to the islanders. The 2004 tsunami pretty much submerged the Maldives for several minutes. In 1987, tidal surges flooded the capital, causing millions of dollars in damage. And Aziz says things are only going to get worse.
We have to survive. We have to find a way to prevent water, seawater coming into the island.
But how? President Gayoom tried political solutions. The Maldives was the first country to sign the Kyoto Protocol to fight global warming. But that hasn't done much yet to slow down sea level rise. So Gayoom, who's ruled the Maldives for 30 years now, has been experimenting with a more hands-on approach, starting with a project near his presidential palace. Here in the capital of Malé, the entire island is surrounded by this massive concrete seawall. And for years, people have been repairing and reinforcing this wall to keep the ocean out. Gayoom got the Japanese government to pay for the wall after the floods of 1987. It cost about $60 million, and it did reduce the vulnerability of Malé, which is only a mile long but houses a third of the country's population. But the wall also makes Malé the least attractive of the Maldives' 200 inhabited islands. So Gayoom, whose power here lets him do pretty much anything he wants, is now trying something a lot more ambitious, just across the lagoon. You catch a ferry from a part of Malé where motorcycles clog the narrow streets and fishermen gut their morning catch on the sidewalk. A few minutes later, you arrive in a brand new world, Hulhumalé. It's an artificial island, built by engineers, not volcanoes. You step up onto this island. The streets are straight and wide. There's a new hospital, new schools, new government buildings, new apartments, and a brand new mosque, all several feet higher than the rest of the Maldives. Kamal Hussein is one of the workers who helped create this flood-resistant island. At the moment, he's fishing off a small pier. Hussein says a huge dredge sucked up sand from the ocean floor and disgorged it into a shallow lagoon. Eventually, Hulhumalé rose from the waters. That was more than 5 years ago. Now, several thousand people live here. Gayoom's goal is to attract 50,000. But unlike their leader, residents don't talk much about climate change. They like Hulhumalé because it's clean. It has wide sand beaches instead of a concrete seawall. Apartments are less expensive than on Malé. These priorities come as no surprise to Mohammed Shaid of the Hulhumalé Development Corporation, which was set up by the government to build and settle the new island.
So yes, the higher elevation of the land is to address the sea level rise, but the primary factor is to create a city to ease the congestion in Malé.
So Gayoom appears to have solved two major problems with one new island. As governments around the world are discovering, most people won't make big changes because of the distant threat of global warming. But they will change for immediate and tangible benefit. Let's face it, we're more likely to buy a hybrid car if we can drive it in the carpool lanes while we're saving the planet. So climate change may not be the main reason Maldivians are moving to their new island, but it has helped the country pay for it. Abdullah Nasir is from the Ministry of Fisheries.
That is an example of how we can adapt to future changes, you know. But then, of course, it involves a lot of costs as well.
The Maldivian government has spent 20 years telling developed nations that they are causing climate change and that they must help pay for solutions like taller islands. Hulhumalé is only half finished, and Gayoom wants to raise portions of several other islands. He was fundraising again just a few weeks ago at the UN's climate change meeting in Bali.
Over half of our islands are eroding at an alarming rate. In some cases, island communities have had to be relocated to safer islands. Without immediate action, the long-term habitation of our tiny islands is in serious doubt.
Thanks to the change in the political climate over the past couple of decades, he's likely to get what he wants. John Hamilton, NPR News.
You can see how global warming may affect coastlines around the world in an animation at npr.org/climateconnections. There you can also get the latest on climate change from National Geographic magazine.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the 286-horsepower TL Type S with a solar sensing climate control system. Learn more at Acura.com.